A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to go deep on Vyvanse pharmacokinetics, specifically around water titration and dose splitting. His psychiatrist actually advocated for this, which is interesting because a lot of doctors won't touch it. The core question is, if you split a Vyvanse dose, say 50-50, 4 hours apart, or maybe a three-part split staggered 2 hours apart, what's actually happening to the blood concentration curve? And are there any consumer-accessible tools that can model this based on your age, weight, and other factors?
This is exactly the kind of question where the standard clinical guidance just shrugs and says, take it as prescribed, but the pharmacokinetics tell a much more interesting story. And the fact that his psychiatrist is on board with this kind of experimentation, that's genuinely refreshing. Most prescribers are still working off the one dose in the morning model and calling it a day.
Which is strange, because the molecule practically begs for this kind of tinkering. It's a prodrug, listixamfetamine demesylate, that's specifically designed to be useless until your body metabolizes it.
And that's the thing that makes water titration viable in the first place, and what makes the whole splitting conversation pharmacokinetically coherent. Listixamfetamine is dextroamfetamine covalently bonded to the amino acid L-lysine. In that form, it's pharmacologically inert. It doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier in any meaningful way. The conversion happens in your red blood cells. An enzyme in erythrocytes cleaves that lysine off, and you get free dextroamfetamine, the active drug. Your red blood cells are basically little amphetamine factories.
Because that enzymatic cleavage is the rate-limiting step, you can't speed it up by snorting or injecting it. The prodrug design is clever as an abuse deterrent mechanism, but it also creates a pharmacokinetic profile fundamentally different from something like Adderall XR, which is just bead-based delayed release. What are the actual numbers? How fast does the conversion happen?
The key parameters, straight from the FDA label and published pharmacokinetic studies. Tmax for the intact listixamfetamine is about 1 hour. But for dextroamfetamine, the active drug, Tmax, is roughly 3.5 hours after a single oral dose. Half-life is about 11 to 12 hours in adults, though it varies with urinary pH. More acidic urine speeds elimination, more alkaline slows it down.
You're looking at a curve that rises over about 3.5 hours, peaks, and then declines with an 11-hour half-life. If you take it at 7 in the morning, you're peaking around 10:30, and by 8 or 9 in the evening, you're still at something like half to two-thirds of peak concentration.
That's exactly the problem the prompt is describing. For a lot of patients, that 3.5-hour ramp is steep enough to feel like a punch. Agitation, jitteriness, sometimes anxiety during the ascent. Then by late afternoon, even though there's still dextroamfetamine in their system, the concentration has dropped below what they need for functional focus. They get the worst of both worlds. Too much during the rise, not enough during the tail.
The Goldilocks problem. But Goldilocks is also on a deadline.
Here's where the splitting gets interesting. If you take half the dose, the Tmax doesn't change. You still peak at 3.5 hours, but the Cmax, the maximum concentration, is roughly halved. Then you take the second half 4 hours later. That second dose starts its own 3.5-hour climb, which means it's peaking around 7.5 hours after the first dose. So instead of one tall mountain, you get two smaller hills, and the valley between them is higher than the tail of the single-dose curve would have been.
The prompt mentions experimenting with different stagger intervals. 2 hours, 4 hours, 6 hours. How much does shifting that window actually change things?
If you move the second dose to just 2 hours after the first, you're stacking the ascending limbs. The first dose is still climbing when the second starts its own ascent. You get a higher combined peak, but it's smoother than a single dose because the first half is smaller. If you push it to 6 hours, the first dose has already peaked and is well into its decline before the second one starts rising. That gives you more of a plateau, longer therapeutic concentration, but at a lower maximum. The 4-hour split is the compromise. The second dose starts climbing just as the first is beginning its descent. The prompt psychiatrist seems to have landed on that as a starting protocol, which makes sense.
What the prompt is really asking is, can we model this precisely? Can we take someone's specific age, weight, renal function, and actually plot the expected plasma concentration curve for a given split regimen? And is there anything consumer accessible that does that?
This is where I have to deliver the disappointing news first. There is no polished consumer app where you plug in 40-year-old male, 75 kilograms, splitting 30 milligrams 4 hours apart, and get a beautiful plasma concentration graph. The clinical pharmacokinetic modeling software that does this properly, things like GastroPlus or SimSip, are physiologically based platforms used by pharmaceutical companies during drug development. They cost tens of thousands of dollars a year and require expertise to run.
The tools exist. They're just not accessible to patients.
But there's a middle ground. There are open source pharmacokinetic modeling libraries in R or Python, like the MergeSolve package or PKPD-SIM, where someone with coding skills can build a compartmental model. The parameters for lisdexamfetamine are published, the absorption rate constant, the conversion rate from prodrug to active drug, the volume of distribution for dextroamphetamine, and the elimination rate constant. All of this is in the literature. And the prompt comes from someone who works in tech and open source development. He could absolutely build this. The basic model isn't that complicated. It's a two-compartment model with first-order absorption and a sequential metabolism step. The gut compartment where the prodrug is absorbed, the central compartment for lisdexamfetamine where it's converted to dextroamphetamine in red blood cells, and then the dextroamphetamine compartment which distributes into tissues and is eliminated renally.
You said the half-life varies with urinary pH. How big a variable is that?
It's substantial, and it's one of the things most patients don't get told. Dextroamphetamine is a weak base. If your urine is acidic from high-protein diets, vitamin C supplementation, certain medications, the half-life can drop to as low as 7 or 8 hours. If it's alkaline, from antacids, vegetarian diets, some diuretics, it can extend to 16 hours or more. That's a factor of 2. It can be the difference between sleeping fine and being wide awake at 2 in the morning. Any modeling tool that doesn't account for urinary pH is going to be off by a significant margin for some people. Age affects glomerular filtration rate, weight affects volume of distribution, but the pH effect can dominate both of those. A 25-year-old with acidic urine might clear the drug faster than a 60-year-old with alkaline urine.
The prompt also asks about making the solution the night before and leaving it in the refrigerator. Is there any degradation concern?
The short answer is no. Lisdexamfetamine in water is remarkably stable. The dimesylate salt dissolves completely and quickly. A study published a few years back specifically looked at stability in various beverage vehicles and found no significant degradation over 24 hours at room temperature, let alone refrigerated. The prodrug bond, that lysine linkage, is not susceptible to hydrolysis under those conditions. It needs the enzymatic cleavage in red blood cells to break. The FDA label explicitly notes that the capsule contents can be emptied into water, orange juice, or yogurt, and that the entire dose disperses immediately. What it doesn't say, but what the stability data support, is that you can prep it the night before and it'll be fine.
Which is useful for the circadian timing piece. The prompt mentions taking the first half immediately upon waking, and if you can have it ready by the bedside, you're not fumbling with capsules at 6 in the morning.
That morning, timing matters for reasons beyond convenience. There's a circadian component to dopamine system sensitivity. Dopamine transporter and receptor expression fluctuate over the 24-hour cycle. Taking a dopaminergic agent at a consistent circadian phase, immediately upon waking, when cortisol is naturally rising and the system is preparing for daytime alertness, aligns the pharmacology with the endogenous rhythm. If you delay the dose by an hour or two on weekends because you slept in, you're pushing the entire curve later, potentially into the evening when dopamine tone should be dropping.
Let's talk about the three-part split the prompt mentions, staggering every 2 hours. What does that curve look like?
If you're taking a total of, say, 30 milligrams and splitting it into three 10-milligram doses at 0, 2, and 4 hours, you're essentially creating a sustained release profile that's smoother than the manufacturer's own extended release design. The first dose starts climbing, the second kicks in while the first is still ascending, and the third arrives just as the first is peaking. The result is a broad, flat plateau rather than a sharp peak. The trade-off is that the maximum concentration is lower. You might not reach the same Kmax as a single dose, but the time above the minimum effective concentration is extended, which might be ideal for someone who needs 12 hours of consistent focus rather than 6 hours of intense focus followed by a crash.
This is where the careful logging the prompt mentions becomes essential. The pharmacokinetic model gives you the predicted plasma concentration, but it doesn't tell you where your personal therapeutic threshold is. The concentration below which you stop getting benefit and start feeling that zombified state.
For some people, that threshold might be surprisingly low. They might need only 5 nanograms per milliliter to maintain focus. For others, it might be much higher. The modeling plus the logging is really the combination. The model tells you the shape of the curve, and the logging tells you where on that curve your symptoms reappear. That combination is vastly underutilized in psychiatry. We're still in this bizarre world where dosing is done by trial and error over weeks or months, when a few days of careful self-observation plus a basic pharmacokinetic model could narrow the optimal regimen dramatically.
The prompt mentions weight as a factor. How much does body weight actually matter for Vyvanse specifically?
Less than people assume, but not zero. Dextroamphetamine distributes widely into tissues. The volume of distribution is roughly 3 to 4 liters per kilogram. So, a 100-kilogram person has a larger distribution volume than a 60-kilogram person, meaning the same dose produces a lower plasma concentration. But the difference isn't as dramatic as it is with something like lithium, where dosing is almost entirely weight-based. With amphetamines, the more important variables are renal function, urinary pH, and, this is underappreciated, the individual variation in red blood cell aminopeptidase activity, the enzyme that cleaves the lysine. The coefficient of variation for the conversion rate is something like 20 to 30%, enough that two people of the same weight taking the same dose can have meaningfully different dextroamphetamine curves. That's another argument for personalized modeling.
The prompt also touches on a concern about becoming sidetracked by optimizing this too precisely. There's a tension between precision and practicality.
I think the prompt's framing of this is exactly right. Nobody's advocating for millimetric dose division. The variations being discussed, 2-hour versus 4-hour versus 6-hour splits, 50-50 versus 60-40 splits, those are coarse enough to be practical but precise enough to produce meaningfully different pharmacokinetic profiles. You're not chasing micrograms. You're making structural changes to the dosing schedule that have predictable, modelable effects on the concentration time curve. It's the difference between tuning a guitar by ear and just hoping the strings are tight enough. Right now, standard prescribing is essentially handing someone a guitar and saying, "This one's pre-tuned, good luck."
Let's get back to the practical question of tools. If someone wanted to build a basic model, what parameters would they need to plug in?
The core parameters are well established. Absorption rate constant for lisdexamfetamine is around 0.8 to 1 per hour, fairly rapid. The conversion rate constant from lisdexamfetamine to dextroamphetamine is approximately 0.5 per hour, reflecting that rate-limiting enzymatic step. Volume of distribution for dextroamphetamine is about 3.5 liters per kilogram. Elimination rate constant is roughly 0.06 per hour at normal urinary pH, corresponding to that 11 to 12 hour half-life. Clearance is about 0.7 liters per hour per kilogram. To model urinary pH effects, you'd adjust the elimination rate constant. Under acidic conditions, pH below about 5.5, the half-life can drop to 7 hours, so the elimination rate constant increases to about 0.1 per hour. Under alkaline conditions, pH above 7.5, the half-life can extend to 16 hours, with an elimination rate constant around 0.04 per hour.
If someone's taking vitamin C supplements in the evening, which a lot of people do, they might be unknowingly accelerating their clearance and wondering why their medication wore off early.
That's a perfect example of why this kind of modeling awareness matters. The standard advice is, don't take vitamin C with your medication because it affects absorption. but with Vyvanse, the absorption isn't the issue. It's the renal elimination hours later. You could take vitamin C at dinner, and it would still affect the tail of the curve. The prodrug design bypasses gastrointestinal pH issues entirely. With Adderall, gastric pH can significantly affect absorption. That's why you get the don't take it with orange juice advice. With Vyvanse, the Lisdex amphetamine is absorbed intact regardless of gastric pH. The conversion happens in the blood, not the gut. So the citrus issue is completely different. It's about renal clearance, not absorption. The folk wisdom about citrus and ADHD meds is mostly wrong for Vyvanse specifically, but it persists because it's true for the mixed amphetamine salts.
The prompt mentions that many patients report the conventional tablet hits too hard, but then doesn't last long enough. Is that a pharmacokinetic reality or a subjective experience?
It's both, and they're connected. The subjective experience of hitting too hard correlates with the rate of rise in plasma concentration, not just the absolute level. A rapid increase in dextroamphetamine concentration produces a more intense sympathomimetic effect than the same concentration achieved more gradually. Heart rate increases, blood pressure rises, the subjective sense of activation is stronger. So the slope matters, not just the peak. Splitting doesn't just lower the peak, it reduces the slope of the ascent. You're making the entire pharmacokinetic experience smoother. The ascent is gentler, the peak is broader, the descent is more gradual. It's a qualitatively different experience, even if the total daily dose is the same.
Let's talk about the afternoon crash specifically. What's happening pharmacokinetically when someone says they feel zombified by 3 p.m.?
What's probably happening is that the plasma concentration has dropped below their individual therapeutic threshold, but it's not zero. So they're not in withdrawal, but they're below the level needed for prefrontal cortical function. The prefrontal cortex is particularly sensitive to dopamine and norepinephrine tone. When the concentration drops, executive function degrades, but the concentration is still declining slowly. It's not a cliff. The crash is partly pharmacological and partly the contrast effect. Going from adequate dopamine tone to inadequate feels worse than never having had adequate tone in the first place. If you're declining slowly from a moderate plateau rather than rapidly from a high peak, the transition is less jarring. And if you've timed the split correctly, the decline happens closer to natural bedtime, when you want dopamine tone to drop anyway.
What's the pharmacokinetic threshold for sleep disruption with dextroamphetamine?
It varies enormously, but the general finding is that plasma concentrations above roughly 5 to 10 nanograms per milliliter at bedtime are likely to interfere with sleep onset or architecture for most people. With a single morning dose and an 11-hour half-life, if you peak at 40 nanograms per milliliter at 10:30 a.m., you're still at maybe 15 to 20 at 10 p.m., above the threshold for many. With a split, because the afternoon dose is smaller and the peak is lower, you can potentially get below that threshold by bedtime. The split isn't just about daytime coverage, it's also about sleep hygiene. That's the part that gets overlooked in standard prescribing. The focus is entirely on daytime symptom control, with sleep treated as a separate issue to be managed with separate medications if necessary. But the pharmacokinetics of the stimulant are directly driving the sleep disruption. Fix the curve, and you might not need the sleep aid.
That's a much more elegant solution than adding trazodone or melatonin on top of a poorly timed stimulant.
You're solving the problem at the source rather than patching the downstream effects.
Beyond building something in Python or R, are there any web-based pharmacokinetic calculators that could approximate this?
There are some general-purpose calculators online, things like ClinCalc or PK Tools, but they're designed for clinical use with standard drugs like vancomycin or aminoglycosides. They don't have Lisdex amphetamine built in. You'd need to enter the parameters manually, and most of them use one-compartment models that wouldn't capture the prodrug conversion step. The prodrug conversion step is essential to the shape of the curve. If you model it as simple immediate release dextroamphetamine, you miss the delayed Tmax and the smoother ascent. The whole point of Vyvanse is that the pharmacokinetics are shaped by that enzymatic step.
What about the published pharmacokinetic studies themselves? Are there graphs or tables that patients could use as reference points?
Yes, and this is actually a practical starting point. The FDA label includes mean plasma concentration time curves for both Lisdex amphetamine and dextroamphetamine at various doses. The published literature has more detailed data, including the effects of food, the linearity of the dose-concentration relationship, and the variability between subjects. A motivated patient could use those as templates and adjust mentally for their own split schedule, though adjust mentally is doing a lot of work there. Which is why I think the prompt's instinct about building a proper model is correct. The math isn't that complicated. It's a system of differential equations that can be solved numerically. Once you have it built, you can run simulations for any split schedule you want.
The prompt mentions that careful logging can yield interesting information. What would you actually tell someone to log?
The minimum useful set would be time of each dose, subjective focus level on a simple 1 to 5 scale at regular intervals, say every 2 hours, time of any noticeable crash or agitation, time of sleep onset, and sleep quality upon waking. If you wanted to get more quantitative, you could add heart rate and blood pressure at a couple of time points, since those are objective correlates of sympathomimetic effect. And if you really wanted to go all in, urinary pH test strips are cheap and would let you track the variable that most affects clearance. You don't need to do this forever. A 2-week logging period with a consistent split schedule would give you enough data to identify patterns. Then you make one adjustment, log for another week, and compare. 3 or 4 iterations, and you've probably found your optimum. Dramatically faster than the standard. Try this dose for a month and come back. Approach.
The prompt psychiatrist sounds like he gets this. The empowering framing is notable.
It's the kind of practice I wish were more common. The paternalistic model of take this exactly as prescribed and don't ask questions is not only disrespectful to patients, it's pharmacokinetically naive. These are intelligent people who can understand the principles and participate in their own treatment optimization.
There's an irony here. Vyvanse is prescribed for ADHD, which impairs executive function. But optimizing your Vyvanse regimen requires exactly the kind of systematic planning and data collection that ADHD makes difficult.
That's a cruel paradox, and it's one reason why having a supportive prescriber who can guide the process is so valuable. The psychiatrist in the prompt isn't just saying, go experiment. He's providing a protocol, a structured approach that reduces the executive function demand on the patient. Start with 50-50, 4 hours apart, log how you feel, come back and we'll adjust. That's scaffolding. That's what good psychiatric care looks like. Not just writing a prescription, but providing the framework for the patient to understand and optimize their own treatment.
Let's circle back to the circadian piece, because the prompt emphasizes taking the first dose immediately upon waking. What's the mechanistic basis for that mattering, beyond just get it in early so it wears off by bedtime?
There are a few layers. First, there's the cortisol awakening response. Cortisol rises sharply in the first 30 to 45 minutes after waking. That cortisol surge naturally enhances alertness and cognitive function. Amphetamines also increase cortisol, so you're getting a synergistic effect if you time the dose to coincide with the natural peak. Second, dopamine transporter expression has a circadian rhythm. It's higher during the active phase, which for humans is daytime. Taking the medication when the transporter is more available means more of the released dopamine stays in the synapse. The circadian system expects a certain temporal pattern of neurotransmitter activity. When you shift that pattern, you're not just affecting sleep, you're potentially affecting mood, appetite, and the entrainment of the clock itself. Dopamine is involved in circadian regulation, not just a downstream output. The immediately upon waking instruction isn't just about practical convenience, it's about aligning the pharmacology with the chronobiology. It's a free intervention. You don't need a new prescription or a different medication, you just need to understand the pharmacokinetics and chronobiology well enough to use them to your advantage.
The prompt mentions that some might see this kind of tinkering as irresponsible. What's your response to that?
I think the irresponsible framing comes from a legitimate concern about stimulant misuse, but it's misapplied here. This isn't about taking more than prescribed or using the medication to get high. It's about taking the prescribed daily dose in a way that optimizes the therapeutic effect and minimizes side effects. That's responsible medication management. What's actually irresponsible is prescribing a psychoactive medication with a complex pharmacokinetic profile and telling the patient nothing about how it works or how to adjust it to their individual needs. The one-size-fits-all approach is the irresponsible one, especially when the pharmacokinetics are as individually variable as they are with amphetamines. Between urinary pH, weight, renal function, and conversion enzyme activity, two patients on the same dose can have wildly different experiences. Pretending otherwise is not clinical precision, it's clinical laziness.
Let's talk about the water titration method itself, since that's the starting point the prompt describes. How precise can you actually be with that?
Vyvanse is fully and rapidly soluble in water. If you dissolve a 30 milligram capsule in 300 milliliters of water, you've got a solution where every 100 milliliters contains 10 milligrams. You can measure that with a kitchen measuring cup or a graduated oral syringe, which you can get at any pharmacy for a few dollars. The solution is clear and the drug is evenly distributed. It's a true solution, not a suspension. So you can titrate in 5 milligram increments if you want to, which is impossible with the standard capsule sizes. The standard doses are 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, and 70 milligrams. If you need something between those, say 25 milligrams, you're out of luck with the capsules alone. But with water titration, you can get any dose you want. For someone starting on the medication or trying to find their minimum effective dose, that granularity is invaluable.
The prompt mentions that intermediate dosages are often impossible to find. Is that a manufacturing issue or a prescribing issue?
It's a manufacturing issue. Shire, now Takeda, produces Vyvanse in those specific capsule strengths. There is no 25 milligram capsule. If your optimal dose falls between the standard sizes, water titration is the only way to get there without jumping to a different medication entirely. Every new capsule strength requires separate manufacturing validation and regulatory approval. The company has determined that the current range covers enough of the market. But for the patients who fall between the cracks, water titration is a legitimate workaround, and it's FDA acknowledged. The label explicitly describes opening the capsule and mixing the contents with water, orange juice, or yogurt. It's presented as an option for patients who have difficulty swallowing capsules, but the implication for dose adjustment is clear. The FDA has essentially blessed the practice.
What about the taste? Is dissolved Vyvanse palatable?
It's essentially tasteless. The dimesylate salt is highly water-soluble and doesn't have a strong flavor. In water, you wouldn't know it's there. In orange juice, it's completely masked. That's another advantage over some other medications where the taste is a barrier. So you've got a tasteless, fully soluble, stable in-solution prodrug that can be precisely divided. It's almost like the molecule was designed for this kind of personalized dosing. I don't think Shire intended it for patient-led dose optimization, but the properties of the molecule certainly enable it. The prodrug design was primarily for abuse deterrence and extended duration, but it had this unintended benefit of making the medication unusually amenable to personalized titration. I'd argue it's one of Vyvanse's biggest practical advantages over other long-acting ADHD medications, and it's barely discussed in the official prescribing information.
Let's get into some numbers on the modeling. If someone were to build a simulation, say, in Python using a simple compartmental model, what would the output look like for a specific scenario? 30 milligrams total, split 50-50, 4 hours apart.
First dose, 15 milligrams at time zero. The dextroamphetamine peaks around 3.5 hours at roughly 20 to 25 nanograms per milliliter, about half the Cmax you'd get from a full 30 milligram dose, which would peak around 40 to 50. So the first half gives you a gentle morning rise. Then at 4 hours, you take the second 15 milligrams. The first dose's dextroamphetamine is just past its peak and starting to decline. The second dose starts its own 3.5 hour climb, peaking around 7.5 hours after the first dose, so around 2:30 or 3 p.m. if you started at 7 a.m. The combined concentration at that point is the declining tail of the first dose, plus the peak of the second, which might give you something like 30 to 35 nanograms per milliliter, higher than either dose alone, but lower than the single dose peak. Then both decline together through the evening. By 10 p.m., you're probably down to 10 to 15 nanograms per milliliter, around the threshold where sleep disruption becomes a concern for many people.
What if you did 60-40 instead, with the larger portion in the morning?
Then your morning peak is higher, closer to the single dose experience, but you still get a meaningful afternoon boost from the 40%. That might work better for someone whose work demands are front-loaded in the morning. Conversely, a 40-60 split with the larger portion in the afternoon might suit someone whose critical tasks are in the afternoon and evening. This is where the logging becomes essential because only the patient knows when their cognitive demands peak. That's not a pharmacological question, it's a lifestyle question. The pharmacology tells you what's possible. The patient's life tells you what's optimal.
The prompt also asks about the general pharmacokinetic data, what the literature tells us about how this molecule behaves across populations. What are the key findings?
A few things stand out. First, the pharmacokinetics are linear. Doubling the dose doubles the plasma concentration. Second, food doesn't significantly affect the pharmacokinetics. You can take it with or without food, and the curve looks essentially the same. Third, there's no accumulation with repeated dosing. Steady state is reached quickly, and the day 7 curve looks like the day 1 curve. That simplifies the modeling considerably. Fourth, the pharmacokinetics in children and adults are similar when adjusted for weight, though children tend to have slightly higher clearance. Fifth, and this is clinically relevant, the conversion efficiency from listix amphetamine to dextroamphetamine is very high. Something like 96% of the prodrug is converted. Very little is excreted unchanged. The lysine cleavage is remarkably reliable. It's an enzymatic target, not random hydrolysis.
The prompt mentions that careful logging can yield interesting information. What kind of patterns have people actually discovered through this kind of self-experimentation?
The most common finding is that the standard once-daily dosing curve doesn't match most people's daily cognitive demand curve. Attention needs typically follow a U-shaped pattern: high in the morning, a dip after lunch, a secondary peak in the late afternoon, and then a decline toward evening. A single Vyvanse dose gives you a single peak. A split dose can approximate the natural biphasic pattern. You're matching the pharmacology to the chronobiology of attention itself. That's the holy grail of ADHD treatment: medication that supports attention when you need it and steps back when you don't. The split protocol isn't perfect, but it's a lot closer than the single dose approach.
What about the concern the prompt raises? The danger of becoming sidetracked by optimizing too precisely?
I think that's a valid caution, and the prompt frames it well. The goal isn't perfection. It's better than the standard approach. With a few course variations, different split ratios, different intervals, you can get most of the benefit without descending into obsessive micro-optimization. The medication is supposed to support your life, not become the center of it.
Let's talk about the broader implications. If this kind of personalized pharmacokinetic optimization works for Vyvanse, what other psychiatric medications might benefit from a similar approach?
Anything with a narrow therapeutic window and significant inter-individual variability. Lithium is the classic example. Dosing is already individualized based on blood levels. But the principle could extend to many antidepressants, antipsychotics, and mood stabilizers. The barrier isn't pharmacological, it's the clinical infrastructure. We don't have a system set up to support patient-led pharmacokinetic optimization. That would require time, education, and a collaborative relationship between prescriber and patient, all of which are in short supply in modern psychiatry. The 15-minute med check is not conducive to this kind of nuanced optimization. The prompt psychiatrist is an outlier in the best possible way. He's practicing the kind of medicine that the system should incentivize, but doesn't.
There's also a regulatory dimension here. The FDA approves medications for specific dosing regimens based on the clinical trials. Anything outside that is technically off-label, even if it's pharmacokinetically rational.
That creates a chilling effect. Prescribers worry about liability if they deviate from the label, even when the deviation is supported by basic pharmacology. The water titration method is label consistent in the sense that the label acknowledges dissolving the capsule contents, but the label doesn't explicitly endorse dose splitting or personalized schedule adjustment. Patients and prescribers are operating in a gray zone between what's pharmacologically sensible and what's regulatorily blessed, which is an uncomfortable place to be, but it's where a lot of good medicine happens. The label is a starting point, not the final word.
Let's wrap up the practical recommendations. If someone listening wants to try this approach, what should they do?
First, talk to your prescriber. This isn't something to do unilaterally, but you can bring the pharmacokinetic rationale to the conversation. Second, start simple. A 50-50 split 4 hours apart is a reasonable default. Third, log systematically for at least a week before making any adjustments. Fourth, pay attention to urinary pH. If you're taking vitamin C or antacids, factor that in. Fifth, don't chase perfection. Find a regimen that works well enough and stick with it.
If they want to build a model, where should they start?
The published pharmacokinetic parameters are available in the FDA label and in papers on Lisdex amphetamine. A basic two-compartment model with first-order absorption and sequential metabolism can be implemented in Python using standard scientific libraries. NumPy and SciPy are sufficient. The differential equations are straightforward. If someone in the community builds an open-source tool for this, it would fill a genuine gap. A simple web app where you input your dose, split ratio, stagger interval, weight, and approximate urinary pH, and it outputs a predicted plasma concentration curve. It wouldn't need to be medically certified, just educational. Here's what the pharmacokinetics predict. Discuss with your doctor. That would democratize something that's currently locked behind expensive clinical software or requires coding skills to access.
The prompt has a lot of layers, but at its core, it's asking a very practical question. If I experiment with dose timing and splitting, what's actually happening in my bloodstream, and how can I predict it? And the answer is, the pharmacokinetics are well understood enough to model. The tools exist but aren't consumer packaged, and the data support the approach as both safe and potentially more effective than standard once daily dosing.
I'd add, the fact that a psychiatrist is advocating for this is a sign of where psychiatry should be heading. Personalized, pharmacokinetics, informed, patient collaborative. It's not radical, it's just good medicine. The molecule cooperates. It's soluble, stable, linear, and predictable. The barrier isn't the pharmacology, it's the clinical culture. And clinical culture changes slowly, but it does change. Conversations like this are part of that change.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early medieval period, scholars in the Aleutian Islands attributed the hunting precision of local bats to divine guidance from the sea god Agugux, believing the bats navigated by whispered prayers rather than sound. It wasn't until centuries later that Western naturalists recognized this as echolocation, and even then, the Aleutian bats were found to use a unique frequency pattern distinct from other bat populations.
Divine guidance via sea god. That's one way to explain sonar.
Whispered prayers is a pretty good metaphor for echolocation, honestly.
Here's the forward-looking thought. As wearables get better at tracking physiological markers, heart rate variability, skin conductance, sleep architecture, we're going to reach a point where pharmacokinetic modeling isn't something you do on a laptop. It's something your watch does automatically, correlating your dosing schedule with your biometrics, and suggesting adjustments in real time. That's not science fiction. The sensors exist. The models exist. They just haven't been connected yet. When they are, the kind of manual optimization we've been discussing will look like the Stone Age of personalized medicine.
The psychiatrists who embrace that future are going to be the ones whose patients actually get better.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for the fact and the production. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com, and if you found this useful, leave us a review wherever you listen.
We'll be back with another one soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.